This is an ABC podcast.
All this week you're hearing stories of unsafe childhoods, and today it's the story of Barbara Laidlaw. Barbara came into the world in very unusual circumstances. She was born in Hong Kong in the year 1942. Her mother had been a society belle in Hong Kong before the war, and her dad was a medical student. When the Japanese invaded Hong Kong, her mother was interned in a prisoner of war camp, and she gave birth to Barbara inside the prison. Now, Barbara has memories of her early childhood there, but she never really fully understood what her mum and dad went through. After the war, her family settled in Australia, and her folks never really talked much at all about those days in Stanley Prison Camp. But in late 2011, Barbara received a phone call. It was an invitation to join a group of people who had been interned at Stanley Prison as children. With this visit and the shared recollections of the group, Barbara was finally able to piece together the story that her parents wouldn't or couldn't talk about. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Richard.
Tell me about the phone call that you got late last year.
Well, I was just about to watch the news. The phone rang. American accent said to me, "Am I speaking to Barbara Laidlaw, who used to be Barbara Hume?" And I immediately thought, "Wow, is my past coming here?" And he introduced himself as Professor Geoffrey Emerson. And he says, "I'm a historian at the Hong Kong University, and I'm organising a reunion for those who were born under Japanese captivity in Stanley Prison." And I said, "Oh, yes." He then went on to say, the sad side is I'm letting you know about this all too late. He said, it's in 4 weeks' time. We want you over here," sort of thing. So I said, "Right, good, I'll come." I then asked if I could bring my brother and sister, because I said, whilst they were born here in Australia after the war, they too would love to know more about how their mum and dad survived. So, and I said, it was never a conversation in our house, so we never learnt too much.
So let's go back then. Let's go right back to the war years. What was your mum doing in Hong Kong? Why was she there?
Well, her dad was a seafaring captain with China Navigation. So he moved the family from Sydney to Hong Kong because that's where he spent more onshore time. So she was 12 when they arrived, so she had to finish her schooling, and then I think she worked for the Texas Oil Company, and then eventually met Dad and they got married. But yes, she did most of her growing up there.
What was her social life like as a young woman in Hong Kong?
Well, I think a lot of the British background people that lived in Hong Kong led a pretty high social life. You know, there was always tiffin and mahjong, and there was cocktail parties, and anyone important in town, they all got to meet, and dinner parties. She and her sister, two very glamorous ladies, which a lot of the elderly people that I'd met over the years always wanted to tell me about my glamorous mother and her sister.
And your dad. Tell me more about your dad, why he was in Hong Kong.
Dad was in the British forces, and he was sent over to Shanghai and then down to Hong Kong. He came out in 1932. He left the Defence Forces. He then took up work in Hong Kong. He met Mum, and they married in 1936.
And he was a medical student, wasn't he? He was going to be a doctor.
He was beginning to study medicine, but it's funny, I haven't been able to find anything very much about that. He started studying medicine, and at the same time, I think he worked for the Hong Kong Health Department, which was also police and health. Seemed to be the same department. I do remember him saying one of his main jobs was checking conditions in the brothel areas, down on the sandpans and in the harbour, etc.
Dangerous job that would have been.
Yes. But it meant he had to learn Cantonese, you see, so he did speak Cantonese, yes.
Now, a bit of the historical background to that time is interesting, because everyone was wondering whether the Japanese were going to strike. They knew that something was going to happen. The Japanese had already invaded China, Manchuria, and they were right up and nestled. The Japanese forces were kind of nestled right up on the border of Hong Kong, which was still the British colony, of course. Mm. What do you know of what happened after Pearl Harbor and the Japanese did invade Hong Kong?
It was actually the same day as Pearl Harbor. They bombed Kai Tak Airport. That's the main airport in Hong Kong. That then was the signal, it's on, the battle's on. Dad at the time was sent, he was in the Hong Kong Voluntary Defence Corps, and he was sent out to the New Territories area, and fighting, a lot of fighting took place there. Now that went on for 17 days and quite many, many lives taken in that battle. Then, of course, the surrender from Britain to Japan happened on Christmas Day 41, Black Christmas, as they refer to. And that's when, of course, the military people were all interned over on the mainland, Kowloon side. Dad was in a camp called Shamshui Po. The civilians, like Mum, who were back living in their lovely houses up on the peak, etc., it was announced and brochures were sent out. They had to assemble at Murray Parade, which is down in the central trading area there.
Oh, God, what dread they would have had of assembling there.
Well, it was. But the thing was, a lot of them didn't get to hear or see these brochures, so they just plodded on in their houses until they were virtually forced to leave. The Japanese came and got them. Mum did tell me that she remembers a Japanese guard coming to her door and telling her she could bring one bag and where she had to report to, and they assembled down in the central area there. They then had to be marched up to the brothel area. Now, it was the cheap brothel hotels that they were put into, because the one thing the Japanese didn't have ready was a civilian camp to put all these people, and there was nearly 3,000 of them. So they had Americans, Dutch, British, the odd Australian, New Zealander. So that's what they used, the brothels. And the conditions there were shocking. I was reading about sitting there on the floor watching the rats crawl over your feet, and the food was shocking. No toilets, you know. It was very poor.
Where did they go from there?
Then some of them were taken by boat around to the south part of the island, where Stanley Prison is. And Stanley Prison is still there today. It's a civilian prison. Just cement blocks they were, very small rooms. They crammed quite a lot of people into the rooms, some with 15, some with 6. No facility, no beds, no nothing. I mean, not even plates, cutlery, nothing.
So your mum went in there without your father, without
Dad
her husband.
Dad was already over in Shamshui Po, although she wouldn't have known that.
She wouldn't have known whether he was alive or dead?
No.
And the other thing was, she was pregnant.
Very.
With you.
Yes.
She was very pregnant.
Well, they didn't move into Stanley Prison until January, late January, and I was born the first week in February.
Now, the story of your birth is really quite remarkable. It's a complicated story because there's an escape story tied into it as well.
That's right. Mum's doctor, Sir Gordon King, he got permission somehow from the commandant to release Mum, because he said, I have to do a caesarean sect. So he could only take her to a little Chinese hospital called the Sun Yuk, which was again up into the central area. He got permission, so Mum, accompanied with 9 guards, was taken to the Sun Yuk hospital. Now, after he delivered me, he whispered into Mum's ear and said, when you get back to the camp, you won't see me. However, promise me you'll drink as much water as you can. And he said, you may be able to breastfeed your baby for quite some time. But he says, I wish you well. Now, what Mum didn't know was that he then camouflaged as a coolie which would have been interesting because apparently he was a very tall, big man.
Right, he disguised himself as a Chinese knight, right, with a big tail and everything, I wonder.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Yes.
And escaped.
Escaped, and what I heard in Hong Kong just recently was that my dad, somehow or other, who was friendly with Sir Gordon, my dad very cleverly managed to get a pistol into Sham Shui Po. Don't know how he did it, but it was obviously property of the British forces somehow. He got it into the camp and then somehow got it out again to get it to Gordon King so that he could go ahead with his escape.
So the man who delivered you, the man who performed a cesarean on your mother to bring you into the world, had a pistol to escape with.
Yes.
Given to him by your dad.
Dad, somehow.
Somehow.
Yes. Dad was supposed to go with them, and I was told that he changed his mind at the last minute, knowing that I'd been delivered and everything was all right. So he felt that if he went as well, they would take it out on Mum.
And maybe you, who knows?
The Japanese were pretty good with children. They didn't hurt children. They probably did in lots of other ways, but they didn't handle them at all. They were quite good with children.
How did your father hear about your birth, your arrival into this world, his first daughter?
He wrote a little diary, and there's a poem in that diary, which is beautiful. He talks about a message being smuggled into his camp in a tin can written on rice paper. How this all happened and took place, I'm not sure. But he got this message saying that what weight I was when I arrived and all well, Kathleen doing okay, you know. He then got someone to sketch a portrait of what he imagined I looked like. And he put it on his prison wall. And the poem addresses all that. It's really
quite lovely. Can you remember part of that poem at all?
Not off by heart, except that at the end he said he talks to everyone that passes his room, his cell as he calls it, to look at his wall because he wants to show off his Barbara Ann and show the world how beautiful she is. So that's in the last verse.
The beautiful Barbara Ann Laidlaw is my guest in conversation today. A woman who was born into a Japanese prisoner of war camp in Hong Kong, where her mother was during the Second World War. Is the story of your birth something you've always known?
Mum had only told me that she told me about being taken to the hospital with the Japanese guards.
Nine guards. I like that.
Yes.
She, a heavily pregnant woman, and she needed nine guards.
Oh, dangerous, these pregnant women.
I reckon, yeah.
And she gave me Gordon King's book to read many, many years ago.
The Doctor Who Escaped.
Yes, he has since written a book. He eventually came to live in Australia, in Western Australia, and became Vice-Chancellor at the university there. But also, we had done a trip to London, Mum and I, and whilst we were in London, we went out to Kew Gardens where she met a doctor called Dr. Selwyn Clark. He was very well known in Hong Kong, a top medical person. He took me for a walk in his garden while his wife and Mum got on with the afternoon tea. He said to me, "Your mother is exceptional." And he says, "I've included a little bit about her and the delivery of you in my book as well." He then said to me something that I thought, what happened? Became aware for the first time that she was probably subject to torture and had never told us. He wasn't going to tell me, but it just stayed on my mind always. At the reunion, a lovely, wonderful lady called Bernice Archer, who's an author of a book, I sat with her on the ferry over to Macau one day, and she heard how the three of us were worrying about our mother and what happened to her. Nobody seemed to be able to tell us. So she came down to my room a few nights before we all packed up to come home, and she said, "Barbara, I'd just like to talk to you and your brother and sister." She told us about going around the world interviewing thousands of women who were interned by Japanese. And she said, "There's one thing that came through loud and clear, Barb." She said, if they had witnessed or knew of someone who had suffered at the hands of the Japs through torture, and that person didn't want to talk about it or pass it on, they would respect that. Nobody will ever tell you. No one will ever tell you. But she said, go home, back to Australia. Just think of what a wonderful, brave woman she was to live all those years and give you such a wonderful life in Sydney growing up.
Meeting Selwyn Clark, he took you aside.
Yes.
Took you on a walk away from your mum to tell you that your mother was a remarkable
exceptional,
woman.
Exceptional,
he said.
Exceptional.
It's interesting. Why do you think he did that? Why did he want to take you away from your mum to tell you how amazing your mother is?
I was interested in, and then he said, for what she suffered. Now, everyone suffered a bit in that camp, but he made it out that it was something that happened to her and only her. I did say to him at that time, she's already told me that her fingernails were burnt off. And I said, we could only relate that to the Coral Sea battle. And he said, oh, yes, yes, yes. He said that was one of the things they did. But he didn't go on. He wasn't going to tell
me. One of the things they did.
Yes.
Why do you think she was tortured? Do you have any idea or any suspicions or guesses?
We can only link it with the... number one, Australia didn't negotiate with Japan. They negotiated with America. Now, 300-odd Americans were released after the first 6 months and sent back to America. Followed, a number of months later, I think in September, the Canadians were released and sent back. Now, that left the British and the Dutch. The British made up of Australians and New Zealanders as well. Australia wouldn't make such a negotiation because they had here in Australia many, many Japanese pearl divers. And those pearl divers knew the Australian coastline like the back of their hand. And Australia and Britain already knew where Japan's intention was to head, and that was to get here. So releasing the pearl divers was a risky thing. So no, they wouldn't negotiate. So the Australian and New Zealanders had to stay on in camp with the British.
While you were in the camp, what did the Japanese tell your mother about the progress of the war? What did they tell her?
Well, they did. Again, we about the time of the Coral Sea battle, so we're looking around about May 42 here, they called her over to their rooms. They put photos in front of her of buildings in Martin Place, Wynyard Station there in Sydney, all with Japanese signs hanging from the wall outside. Mum, who hadn't realised that Japan had even the intention of getting to Australia, looked at them and thought, oh my goodness, they're already there.
They've occupied Australia.
Yes.
Why would they do that? Why would they want to convince your mother, who's their prisoner, of their great victory over Australia, which was all a ridiculous lie?
Well, I think, again, to get her to tell them as much about Australia as she could, overlooking the fact that she was 12 when she stopped living there, but what they were aware of, that she and Dad had paid a visit to Australia the year before on a holiday, hence the wax tapes put under the fingernails. And for every question she didn't answer, they would burn closer.
That's just insane. I mean, that's crazy that they thought she would know defence secrets on the basis of that. That
puzzled her because she said, believe it or not, some Japanese fellows were highly intelligent chaps, you know. And the money, the ready printed money, Australian money with the Japanese printing on it, and the Emperor's picture on one side of it.
Australian banknotes.
So
Barbara, there was a birth certificate for you, wasn't there?
From the Emperor of Japan, yes.
The Emperor Hirohito, yes, welcoming you to the world.
A little card, welcome me as the daughter of the Emperor of Japan, yes. And that was it. And the only other thing was a piece of paper that Gordon King scribbled on the day I was born, just putting Mum's name, the date and time of birth, and that I was known as Barbara. And
what do you know of how life in the camp was managed, how the people who were interned managed day-to-day life?
Well, I've learnt more about that, books I've read, but on the time of the reunion I learnt a lot because we spent a whole day out at Stanley Prison. And the corrective services officer who guided us around there, and she took us upstairs to the block that we were in. Victor knew more than I did, because Victor was nearly four when he went into the camp, and he could remember a lot of things. And as we were walking back down the staircase with this corrective services officer, I said, hold on, as we turned to go down the next flight, I said, oh, this, something happened here, something happened to me here. And Victor sort of looked at me, you know, and the corrective services didn't know what I was on about. I knew there was a Japanese guard involved, and it all came out later, talking to the other people that were in the camp. Ah, said one lady from New Zealand, Daphne. She said, you were coming down the steps very fast, suddenly turned the bend, got to about the fourth or fifth step when the Japanese guards yelled at you.
Why did they yell at you?
Yelled at me to come down and stand next to him, because the one thing you never did was stand higher than a Japanese guard. You had to be down on ground level with him with your head bowed. And if children didn't do this, they would take it out on the mothers.
So by the sheer random circumstance of you being on the top of the steps,
higher than him.
You were higher than the Japanese officer.
Yes.
That was an offence for which your mother needed to be punished.
Yes.
How was she punished?
She fled up the stairs past me and went to her room, yelling, screaming. This has all been told to me, so I can't remember this part. Yelling and screaming at her, and she would have been whacked across the face and pushed against the wall, and yes, they belted them up was the common term. Yes.
Do you remember playing? Do you have memories?
I do, and I was able to talk to my friend Victor about this when we were in the prison area. I said, Victor, what, we kids, we played down on this grass area here, didn't we? And he says, yeah, it wasn't grass in those days, it was dirt. And I said, why can I see my mother up there on the balcony yelling and screaming at me? Oh, he said, that was an air raid. We used to get called up when the air raids were on. And I put together, I could remember Mum putting me on the floor, laying on top of me, and me complaining like mad, get off me, you're hurting me. Sadly, towards the end of the war, an American plane did go over and bombed one of the bungalows that had 30-odd people in it. And that was towards the end of the war, yes.
But your mum lay on top of you to protect you.
Well, I think all the parents were doing it to the little ones.
There was a man hanging from a parachute, wasn't there?
Yes. That was at that bombing at the end of the war. And he hung from one of the buildings. And I was out with my nan walking. And I saw it. And there was this man hanging. He would have been from that American aircraft. They were apparently trying to bomb ships in the harbour. And I think the Japanese might have got his plane first. I don't know.
Liberation of Stanley Prison Camp, where you were.
Yes.
Do you have any memories of liberation of soldiers coming to the camp?
I can remember the soldiers coming, and they brought sweets, they brought good food, and they brought clothing. Red Cross were ongoing supporters the whole time we were in that camp. And then, of course, at the end, they were so active and involved in coming in, making life more comfortable for us until we were repatriated. They were wonderful. I can remember the American soldiers. They're the ones that had all the lollies and drinks and everything. Our little tummies weren't ready for that. I can remember being very ill, vomiting everywhere because I'd eaten jelly beans and had Coca-Cola. So,
the wretched guards at Stanley. What happened to them?
The Japanese. That's one thing I do remember. I can remember saying to Mum, those men are making awful noises. They were committing harikari because a lot of them took their lives once the surrender from Japan back to Britain had taken place. They did that sort of thing very much in private. I do remember as the war finished, we were kept on in the camp because it took a long time to organise us and where we were to go, etc. They brought trucks in to take the women, like Mum, over to Shamshui Po to meet their husbands, to see their husbands. I'd never seen a truck before, and I can remember my grandmother, who was interned with us, picking me up, Mum up on the tray of the truck, saying, "Come on, it's all right." I'm screaming, kicking, yelling. There's no way I was getting on that monstrous big thing that made that horrible loud noise. They must have got me on. I don't remember much more, except when we got to Shamshui Po, I can remember being introduced to my father, who I didn't want to have anything to do with, and he cuddled my mother. And that was it. I thumped into him.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Now, Barbara, you just said before that when you met your father for the very first time after the war was over and the camp had been liberated, you saw him embrace your mum and then you started punching him. Why did you punch him?
I'd never seen him before. I don't know. Mum must have told me I had a father somewhere, but I'd never seen he had the audacity to put his arms around my mother. How dare he?
Do you remember what he looked like?
Tall, skinny.
Oh, how skinny, though?
Oh, well, 4 stone. 4 stone he weighed, and he was a 6'6" man, so he looked pretty bad.
I don't know. You could be 6'6" and 4 stone. That's...
Mm. He had tuberculosis. He had one lung collapsed and TB in the remaining lung. So he was in a bad way. They were putting him into hospital there. Then Mum and I were put on a ship. I remember this. We were sent to Singapore. And at this stage, we joined in with the Changi people. And we lived in the beautiful Raffles Hotel for a few weeks while they organised where we were going. We were told we'd have to go to Britain because Dad was British. We were actually boarding the ship to go to Britain with all the others. However, a telegram came through saying that Dad could not survive in Britain. He'd have to go to Australia.
Because of his lungs?
His lungs, yes.
Well, his lungs singular now, isn't it? Do you remember seeing those POWs, the people who came out of Changi?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they were with us in Raffles, a lot of them, but I can remember tearing up and down the verandas of Raffles, lovely wide colonial-looking verandas, beautiful, and meeting new children. So I can only think that they were perhaps the Changi children. But we all eventually landed on a ship for Australia, and that was Changi, and then she did a small cruise down through the islands, picking up prisoners of war all the way. So we didn't get to Sydney for quite a while.
And when you arrive in Sydney, do you have a picture in your head of arriving?
Oh, yes, yes, I remember that. I looked down, and there were all these ladies in white dresses and veils. And I said to Mum, "Are they the fairies you told me about?" They were Red Cross ladies. And Mum said, "No, they belong to an order. They're nurses, and they're all going to come and look after us," you know, which they did.
When you went to school in Australia, was it hard to blend in?
It was. We were billeted to families. One of our first families was down in Albury. He was a Commonwealth Bank manager. And they started me at kindergarten. That's where I began to notice that people would stop me on the street and make me talk. And then they'd laugh. Mum used to get very angry.
Why? What was your voice like?
I was frightfully British colonial.
Did you sound like the Queen in the 1950s?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Young man, come help me with my portmanteau.
Yes, I can imagine it. Although I wouldn't be saying those words. But
that wouldn't be nice, actually. That would have been awful. Well, not awful. That wouldn't have been very nice.
Australian kiddies hadn't heard that much of an accent before, especially in the country at Albury, you know. But I think one thing I do remember was it was Empire Day, and we used to fly the flag, 24th of May, fly the flag in the playground and go up and come down. And there was me down on the ground. And the teacher said, Barbara, you don't have to do that here. So you bow to the Japanese flag.
You were bowing to the flag.
Bowing to the flag, yes. It had been a bit of a practice one had back in the camp. So apparently it made a picture in the local newspaper. So another laugh.
How long did it take for you to get used to the presence of your father?
Oh, Dad, quite a long time. I can honestly say, Dad, eventually he spent about a year and a half in hospital here in Australia, mainly at Concord in Sydney. He then joined us and we were given a little flat at Bondi, where I went to school. He was still that man, I referred to him. Would you ask that man to give me this, or would you ask that man...
And in a postured voice, will you ask that man to pass the sauce bottle, please? Were you like that?
I can imagine I was.
Poor Dad.
Yes. But then a little brother came on the scene, and I began to notice him getting a lot of attention. That hurt quite a bit. I can remember that.
Attention from that man.
That man and my mother, you see. Yes, I'd had Mum all to myself up until then. And then we went to live up in the country for a little while at Laurieton. And then we went back to Sydney and lived at Dundas, and my sister arrived. So at this stage, I was well and truly speaking with an Aussie accent. So,
how did your dad get on after the war with just the one lung? How was he getting on professionally? And
professionally, he couldn't do medicine. He'd have to start again, and he had a wife and child to look after at that stage. So he became a podiatrist in the Sydney Foot Clinic. And then, would you believe, after 18 months, it closed. Australians just weren't into Cropley in those days. And that's when we went up to the country, and he did a job as an accountant, paymaster, foreman, whatever. We came back to Sydney. He then became one of the head... he wasn't a qualified accountant, but he was very good at it. So he did all the pay for Peakfreen biscuits, which was in existence in those days. And he eventually, only 2 years before he died, became the a medical advisor for Drunk Houses Australia. So he was getting close back to the medicine that he loved. And we were living in a better state, shall we say. We had nothing. There was absolutely nothing. I mean, when we arrived, those lovely nurses, Red Cross girls, they took us to Mark Foy's and clothed us. And I had to wear shoes, those horrible things called shoes. I screamed the place down again, didn't want to put shoes on. So we worked up, but he died. Mum was only in her 40s when he died, and he was 49.
Why did he die so young?
Heart. Like many, he put a lot of weight on. Mum became an excellent cook. She never had to cook in Hong Kong. But she learnt, and she learnt well. She used to love doing his jam roly-polies, his Yorkshire puddings. It was almost as though she was making up for all that lost time of starvation, you know. And
so then your mum, in her early 40s, was left with three kids.
Three children, that's
right. How did she manage, Barbara?
It was scary for her because in those days, this was 1956, she knew that if she went to work, which she had to do... It took years for the British war pension to come through to her, which was smaller than Centrelink here at the time. She got a job at David Jones in the city. The children, John and Jan, my brother and sister, they were put into the Masonic School at Baulkham Hills, which was terrible. That was terrible.
Was it like a boarding school? Was it?
Yes, it was really an orphanage for the children of Freemasons who had died. And... Mum knew if she kept them at home, children's services would have stepped in and taken them and put them into one of their homes. So she chose to let them go to the Freemasons home, which they stayed at until they left school.
And she kept you by her side. How old were you?
I was 14 when Dad died. They wouldn't take children past 12. Plus, I was in my last year at school and started at the... ABC, would you believe, in 1957.
Did your mum's health suffer after the war as well, Barbara?
Mum did very well, other than being a bronchial asthmatic. She soldiered on very, very well. She, like many, had her gallbladder removed a few years after arriving here, again going from that sort of terrible diet to the Western good food, or
and all that dairy, you wouldn't have had any dairy at all. It's just all condensed milk in those days, wasn't it?
That was what was dropped by the Red Cross supplies. Although I've since found out they crush soybeans to get milk.
I just think about what your mum's life, the arc of her life has been like. There she is, living this amazing, beautiful, and exciting, and glamorous, and privileged life in Hong Kong. And then a brutalised interning.
What, 10 years after Dad dies? And
then it's very hard graft for her, isn't it?
Yes, suddenly to work. She had worked in the Texas Oil Company back in Hong Kong, but I can remember Dad died in the school holidays. The day after his funeral, she hired a typewriter. I had to show her how to type. I could hear her up to 1 o'clock in the morning, keying away on this typewriter, determined to get a job, which she did. So
in the decade after the war, did your mum and dad stay in touch with other people who'd been interned with them?
Oh, yes. We had many expatriates come to our house for nice little dinner parties. And the interesting thing, as I was in my teenage years at this stage, I can remember the conversations in our lounge room.
Were you allowed to overhear?
For a while. I was often sent out with the other children, go and watch the other children, or would you go and do this or something, But they would talk endlessly about the hilarious things and the antics they got up to in the pre-war years, leading that high social life. And they'd talk about, remember the day he did this. They'd go over and over that. The camp, they talked about funny things. Never heard anyone mention anything that was negative or gruesome in any way.
Why? There's no one who's going to be shocked by what they all knew what they'd gone through. Why do you think they didn't do that?
As Bernice Archer put it, it's almost an unsigned understanding they all had amongst them. They just never talked about those things.
Do you think now, you've got a fair bit of wisdom about this stuff. Do you think they were wise not to talk about it, or would they have been better off going through that?
I think that would have depended a lot on the individuals. I've since learned many did come back, not just here but to Britain, and suffered badly with depression and mental illness. Some, not all. Some just became a total closed book. One fellow was telling me his father just said, "We just don't talk Hong Kong at all, if you don't mind, Different people handled it in different ways. Probably one of the interesting things that came out of our visit last year was talking to some of the other internees, and when we were getting a little bit deep in our conversation, several of us had to admit to a post-trauma depression ourselves. Suddenly in our older age, this big need to know, because we all came from parents who wouldn't talk about it, and quite a few of them, like myself, had gone off to see psychologists who took us through the post-trauma.
You became depressed later in life?
I found myself going through Mum's memorabilia all the time. I'd only have to see a movie on the television or something. I think what spurred a lot of it off was I went and saw Paradise Road, Bruce Beresford's film, and I heard him being interviewed on ABC. He was here for a film festival, and he said he had got a lot of ideas for that film. He went to Hong Kong and talked to some people about the brutalities and what they did.
You went and saw that with your mum, didn't you, when she was alive?
Yes.
What effect did that have on your mum, going to see that movie Paradise Road?
She wanted to see it. She virtually fled from the cinema.
Why? At what point?
I thought at first it was the scene with Cate Blanchett taking the role of being tied up and leaning over the stake. The idea was once she would fall asleep, the stake would go through her. and everybody watching. You know, this is one thing the Japanese used to make sure that the other internees would watch these things. And well, soon after that, she sort of fled, and I went out after her, and I said, "What is it? What is it?" And she said, go back in. Just, you know, leave me alone." She was really quite angry that I came out.
Why did she want you to go back in? That's interesting.
I don't know.
She wanted you to know, but she couldn't bear it.
No.
Had she been forced, she'd been tortured herself. Had she been forced to watch people being tortured?
Oh, they did. Not an awful lot. The seven men who smuggled the radio into the camp or put one together, once they were found, they were executed. I don't know if people were made to watch that. But I do know there were occasions there when the Japanese were torturing or executing internees, were forced to watch. How many and who they were, I don't know. That doesn't seem to come out, you know. It's one of the no-no subjects.
Barbara, you and your mum visited, as you said, Stanley Prison, the prison where you were born, together at one stage. How old were you about then?
That would have been in 77.
So early 30s then.
Mid-30s, yes.
And you went to visit some of the grave sites of people who died while they were interned. Mm. What was that like? What did your mum say when you were there?
We took a long time in that cemetery, and Mum was able to tell me something about every one of them, which was the first time I'd heard her open up. But she never told me what actually happened. I have since found out that many of them just died from malnourishment or beriberi, whatever they contracted, and a lot of them were people over their 50s. But there are a few children in there as well. One little boy who drowned down on the beach. We were lucky at Stanley, we had a beach nearby, which enabled the men to fish for food and children to swim. But a little boy drowned.
Your mum, the thing was, though, going back to Stanley Prison, that wasn't the biggest thing for your mum going back to Hong Kong. She preferred to dwell on the pre-war days, didn't she?
Loved talking pre-war. We met up with a few of her pre-war friends who had gone back and resettled in Hong Kong.
Maybe your mum felt like the light from the pre-war years would be enough to shine on the darkness and drive the darkness of the war years a little bit away.
Yes, I think recapturing a lot of that. There weren't that many people back there at that stage that she would have known in those pre-war years. But an interesting thing happened. We were coming off the Star Ferry on Kowloon side, where our hotel was, and walking towards us was this extremely glamorous woman with a teenage girl. And she had a long cigarette, you know. And I looked at her and I said, "Mum, that lady that just passed us, that's not Alison, your sister." And Mum turned around and immediately recognised her, ran up to her. And Alison turned around and looked down and said, "Oh, oh, what are you doing here?" "You haven't seen her since the war years." I had to laugh. And
had she been interned in the camp as well?
But she was married to an American, so she was only there until the June, and then they were repatriated back to America.
Okay, now her story is a whole different story as well.
Oh,
it's a side story, but it's just so compelling. I have to ask you to tell it. The glamorous and preposterous Alison.
They went to New York. They settled there. She had another two children. She had Madeline in the camp, was born just a month after me. Went to America. Her marriage to Reg didn't last very long, and she then took herself to Europe, to England and Paris. She was a top model at this stage. We used to receive beautiful Vogue magazines with her picture on the front cover. Beautiful, lovely, stunning looking woman. She was able to put her three children through top private boarding schools in Britain while she was working. My cousin since told me that she was not a good mother, unfortunately.
Wasn't interested.
Not interested. No. Not interested. Sad thing was, she eventually went back to remarried a very wealthy Russian Jewish chap called Voy Werner. Voy was very big in the American bank. They sold their villa on the Isle of Capri in Italy and moved to Hong Kong so Alison could be in her territory. She wanted badly to live back in Hong Kong. Apparently, she did nothing but throw cocktail parties. They rented the penthouse on the Mandarin Hotel there and entertained everyone in Hong Kong who had a name, I think. They slyly went through all their money. The next thing we heard, she was virtually destitute and Voy had died. She actually asked my mother to pay for a grave for Voy, which my mother did. I was passing through Hong Kong, coming home from London at one stage, and phoned her in Hong Kong and said, I'd love to meet you. So she arranged to meet me in the Mandarin Hotel. At this stage, she was living elsewhere, not in very good conditions. But I saw her. I was sitting in the foyer and I watched up through the main door. She came to the bellboy, paid him some money, and then went out the door again. And I thought, oh, where is she going? You know? She then came back and he announced her, you know, in the old days, Mrs. Alison Werner, you know. And dear Alison, yes. I mean, she was getting old at this stage.
So she came, she swanned in then. She needed to be announced before she could walk into the Mandarin Hotel.
Yes.
Did she have a penny to her name?
She didn't have much money to her name. As a matter of fact, I think I bought lunch that day and after she insisting she would, but then she said she owed too much money and she couldn't do it.
And how was her funeral?
She died just before we arrived in Hong Kong in this just months gone by. And if it wasn't for our friend Jason Wordy, the historian friend from Queensland, he knew her. He and three others, I think, attended the funeral. It was the real pauper funeral. Now, her son-in-law in Britain had paid for her rent. He paid for all her medical costs and gave her an allowance and virtually kept her in Hong Kong. The daughter, Madeline, my age, she had nothing to do with her mother or very little. And the other three, she had another daughter with a second marriage. They didn't want anything to do with her or even know about her. So Jason went to the funeral. He stood outside the building where the funeral was to be held, saw a cardboard box dumped by a courier on the pavement. And he looked and thought, oh, yes, they put big gladioli in those long boxes. But then he saw Alison Werner written on the side of the box. He thought, oh, no, surely not.
Well, that was her coffin?
That was her cardboard box. So the next thing he knows, he's upstairs in a room. The cardboard box is there on a table. In walks a lady who said, oh, we're here for Alison Werner. Does anybody want to say anything? Jason looked around. Nobody was going to say something. He stepped forward, spoke for about 5-10 minutes, and then that's it. The coffin went out on the conveyor belt through the door, and because Jason speaks fluent Cantonese, he could hear the workmen behind the shutters yelling out, cart number 3 coming through, get rid of it. Oh, put it over there on the bench. We'll do this one first. Get rid of that one. He thought, how awful, how awful. Not anyone from the clergy there, nothing. And in Jason's eyes, it was just the worst thing he'd ever experienced. He couldn't believe it. So unfortunately, we weren't there when that happened.
Barbara, just looking back on that time, on your time as a small girl in that Japanese internment camp, are you able to trust your own memories or do they mingle with other accounts?
Well, they're like flashes. You get like the scene on the staircase. I could just see myself on the staircase being terrified of something. I can visualise a Japanese guard. But I can't link it all up. And a lot of us were having that problem, flashes of things. Did we dream it? Did this happen? Has someone told us about this?
You said when you came back just recently from Hong Kong, having spent all that time with those other people who'd been children alongside you in turn, you had such a great appreciation of your mother, didn't you?
Oh, I did. When I think all of us, when we saw the conditions and how they coped, how they got us into clothing, feeding, the food.
She lay on top of you during air raids.
Yes, yes.
And the life your mother led and the life your auntie led.
Very different after the war, yes.
How lucky you were to be your mother's daughter.
Yes, she's a lovely, kind woman, did a lot for people. As a matter of fact, when we were given money by the British government in 2001, quite a sizable amount of Mum's money went to the Red Cross. She was just endlessly thankful to those people. She joined the Red Cross herself and always reminded me of how helpful they were.
And now you work as a volunteer at an airport. Many people listening to this might think that it'd be natural for you to feel some, I don't know, some malice towards Japanese people or something. Do you have that?
No, I don't. I've been asked that. Some of the people I work with at the airport are watching the Japanese tourists coming through, particularly the ones in my age group and a bit older. I just look at them. I smile. They smile. And I just immediately think of the bombing of Hiroshima. I don't. And think, yes, you had a lot of innocent people suffer too. I don't know. Mum used to always say, Hiroshima, Barbara gave us our freedom. But that was Mum. I can't quite think that way. But I look at them coming through the airport there. I talk to them, those that understand me. And they're nice. Yes.
Barbara, I've so enjoyed this conversation. You've been a fascinating guest today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
I spoke to Barbara Laidlaw in 2012, and on her return from the reunion in Hong Kong, Barbara shared these thoughts with us. She wrote, "The journey was absolutely overwhelming, emotionally exhausting. Hurtful things were learnt, but most of all, the bonding that took place between us was so rewarding." She wrote, "The majority of us had parents who would not share the happenings in Stanley during all those years. So here we are coming into our 70s and wanting to know more about the day-to-day living in the camp and how our mum and dad survived. We have come home absolutely so proud of our parents." I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.